Five Live's Daily Mayo podcast, delivered to your computer every weekday. For more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live. Hello and welcome to another Daily Mayo. Today we spoke to the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams. He spoke about the Chilcot inquiry, the splits in the Anglican Church, but began by giving his explanation, because a listener asked, of what God sounds like. Good afternoon to you, sir.
Hello.
How are you?
Okay, cold and a bit wet.
It is. It was snowing when I arrived. It's still snowing.
Still snowing, and I was recording the New Year message earlier today, and it was snowing quite hard
then. What do you say in your New Year message, or is that...
Ah, that's a trade secret.
It's under some kind of embargo, is it?
That's right.
Do you enjoy the festive period? Because clearly it is an extremely busy time for you, but I do know some clergy who kind of approach it with a lead weight. A little bit around the next, you're thinking, oh, you know, many things to do.
I think if you're a vicar on your 17th carol service, it can be a bit dispiriting. But I have to say, I love it. We go down to Canterbury, we'll be down there on Friday night, and then a series of services, parties for the choir boys, that sort of thing, visit to the prison, and the big Christmas morning service. Yes, wonderful.
And really do you feel as though you have to come up with something new and different every Christmas? Because clearly that's what you can tell if you listen to Christmas sermons, that a new angle is trying to, I'm sure there'll be a number of vicars trying to think of an X factor thing that they can crowbar in. Do you have to be different and innovative?
Well, I was thinking of a cartoon I saw. The caption was, the congregation joined in the familiar, well-loved words of the vicar's Christmas sermon. I guess there are quite a few like that. Yeah, there's a feeling you've got to find something new to say, but... Actually, if it was good news last year and the year before, it's probably worth saying again. You just find new angles into it, new images, new metaphors, maybe.
I can't promise you. In fact, I can guarantee that we haven't got Ricky Gervais on the programme.
Oh, shame that.
Because last time you were here, Ricky Gervais was here as well. In fact, you can still watch it on YouTube. And we've made a programme with sort of the best bits of 9 years of this programme. And it concludes with... You, Dr. Williams, with Ricky Gervais, arguing about eternity.
Arguing about eternity, yes.
What finer place is there to finish? I do want to start with some listeners' questions, because there's all kinds of things to speak to you about in the half hour that we have. I was intrigued by this, which I know you don't tweet, because we were just talking about Twitter during the news, because the Archbishop of York tweets on a regular basis.
Yes, he's much more computer literate than I am.
Is all sorts of well, ways. This came through last night. It comes from Dylan, who's in your neck of the woods. He's in Canterbury. But I was intrigued by the question. He says, what does God sound like? I try to listen, but I hear nothing. Am I deaf?
What does God sound like? The best picture in the Bible, of course, is the still small voice. You know, there's a great big explosion of... dramatic events, thunderstorms, and so forth in the story of the prophet Elijah. And then after it all, there's a silence, and then the prophet knows that somebody's speaking to him. And it sounds very strange to say that, but actually it's quiet that God sounds like, I think, for an awful lot of people. When the voices inside your head, all the sort of nagging voices, fall silent, and the voices outside fall silent, and you just have a bit of time simply to be still, and it's not empty. I think that's what God most sounds like. You don't hear voices, or not many people do, and you worry a bit about some of those who say they do. I think it's quiet.
If you're saying it's quiet, and Dylan is saying he's trying to listen but he hears nothing, is it there but he has to wait for it to get quieter? Or
it's there, and I think it may be that if Dylan gives a bit of time just to sitting and breathing. And letting that quiet come in, then later on you may realise that a difference has been made.
You must meet many people in your job who sound as though they have a hotline to the Almighty. It sounds as though they were talking to him just this morning, and while they were there, God told them a couple of things, and it's hard to argue against that. Are you automatically suspicious when you hear that?
If somebody simply writes in to me and says, God told me to tell you this, I'd want to say, well, why do you think it's God? Why, how do you know it's not just you? Have you talked about it with other Christians? Have you... sat down and read your Bible a bit with that in mind? Have you given your mind to it? Because I think just an individual saying, well, this is God, nobody's going to be terribly persuaded by that. Even in the Bible, you know, people hear the voice of God in the context of other people talking about God, of the slow discovery of something. It's not all miracles and visions. They happen to some people. But for most people, it is this gradual process of things getting clear.
Do you hear the voice of God?
In words, no. In quiet, I listen, and I know that I'm loved, that I'm attended to, and that that time of listening nourishes me and makes a difference and sends me out a different person. Yes, I hear God in that sense.
There's an email question here from Laurie in Tunbridge. There is a huge prejudice, Simon, against the church. Children of vicars are often teased and bullied, and the general picture of churchgoers is of a bunch of pious do-gooders. I'm not a regular churchgoer, says Laurie, but my experience of the Church of England has shown that these prejudices are hopelessly out of date. Why does the Archbishop think that these outdated impressions persist, and what can be done to change them?
That's a wonderful comment, because I think it comes out of actual face-to-face experience, whereas a lot of people just work with clichés and, you know, stereotypes. The stereotype is something to do, I guess, with a generation or two back when people's memory of church was that they just had to sit and be quiet, in a rather different sense from what I was talking about just now. Be quiet and be talked at and sung at for an hour on end, and, you know, you don't move, you don't have any chance to be yourself. And that dies very slowly, I think, that sense that that's what church is about. And then, of course, the fact is that the big issues that a lot of people, with due respect in the media, are interested in the church, are the conflict issues, and the church apparently getting into a conflict about things that are very hard to understand, or very hard for people to see why they're important. So that certainly doesn't help us.
Do you recognise the picture that our listener paints here of the children of vicars being teased or bullied?
Yeah, sadly I do. And I think it's one of the greatest sacrifices that some clergy make. They take their families into really, really socially demanding situations. They'll be the only professional people often living in a really deprived community. Doctor doesn't live there, social worker doesn't live there, the teachers don't live there. The parish priest does. And that means that his or her family is really going to be on the receiving end of a lot of mockery, a lot of bullying, real bullying sometimes in school. It's one of the saddest things that undermines the morale of some clergy and makes it difficult to go to places like that. I'm amazed at the courage so many show.
And Laurie's final point, what could be done to change this? I mean, is there something that the media has to look to itself and the government has to look to its policies, but is there more that the church can do to recognise that these are, it sounds as though these are people on the front line making extraordinary sacrifices?
I think they are, and actually, that message from Laurie just indicated that when you go and see what's happening, when you actually go through the door, it looks different. But what the church then has to do, I think, is to come through the door from its side and take its message out there. I think a lot of the work that's been done over the last, I don't know, 6-7 years with the movement we're calling Fresh Expressions in the Church of England, that's taking kind of church life to places where it hasn't been before. Weekday evenings for young people, mothers and toddlers groups, sometimes also meetings for older people, just going out of the church building, away from Sunday morning, finding people where they are and making community there. There's a lot of that. And about, I suppose about, I don't know, I think it's somewhere in the region of 8,000 new ventures like that springing up around the country.
Here's another aspect of the front line, if you like, Graham, in Finchley. Richard Dawkins is fond of saying that even the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Pope accept evolution. This seems slightly surprising, since one would assume that a man of religion might favour something along the lines of intelligent design. Please would you clarify the extent to which you accept evolution, with special reference to natural selection and the random blind forces which are assumed to lie behind it? A huge debate and part of a bigger atheist and science discussion as well, but your reaction to that, Archbishop?
First of all, I have no problem at all with evolution. It's a very credible theory about how things got to be the way they are. And I guess, like probably the majority of modern Christians, I'd say that God should make a world designed to evolve, designed to develop in that way, causes me no difficulties at all. You find that sort of view advanced even in the first centuries of the Christian church. God makes a world that has the capacity to change and develop. The problems come, I think, in two ways, from two sides. The intelligent design idea seems sometimes to talk as if the original design was a little bit faulty and God has to keep on stepping in to make a little link, rather than putting it all into the works from the beginning. And I don't see why I should need to believe that. God's designed the whole thing. That's what explains, if you like, the entire hanging together of the universe. On the other side, the problem with natural selection, I think, is that it's a phrase used in a kind of shorthand, as if the basic reality was always competition and kind of cutthroat competition at that. Everything's a zero-sum game. That's not actually how Darwin thought evolution worked, and it's not actually how scientists want to see the natural world these days. There's more and more emphasis on the role of cooperation in evolutionary advantage, as well as competition. So the danger comes when you take an idea from science, natural selection, apply it to the whole field of science, and then to the whole field of everything else as well.
Certainly in the time that you've been Archbishop, you will have looked at these debates, for which Graham's question was just a part of. And it does seem to many commentators that there's no doubt in the last few years the kind of noisy atheism, if you like, as opposed to the quieter side, has been out there. And certainly it's not whenever, particularly for some reason, comedians are on television, whether it be Bill Bailey or whether it be Eddie Izzard, they will come on, and indeed Ricky Gervais, as you were arguing a couple of years ago, and they have a point, and they are saying, you know, that science is where we will find the answers, and that religion needs to take a back seat and religion needs to engage with this. Do you think it's an intellectual battle that the religious community have been a bit slow in taking up?
I think that there is a big intellectual battle to be had. And quite a few people, of course, have been taking the battle into the enemy's camp, as it were. Ordained scientists who are actually priests and believers. And quite a few of them. There's a society of ordained scientists in this country who are respected senior mainstream scientific researchers who also happen to be Christian priests. So there is a kind of pushback here. I think the difficulty often is not just on the level of intellectual battle. It's perceptions, it's, again, clichés and stereotypes that get around. And when people say it's to science we look for the answers, I would say, well, the answers to which questions? Science will answer the questions you pose in scientific terms. Of course it will, and it answers them very well. Does science, in that general sense, answer any sorts of questions about human value, what's actually worth living for, living with, about why the imagination, the heart, trust, love matter? Well, that's not science's province, and that's not to do down science, just to say that if you ask those questions, you're not going to find the answers there.
If we can then... We'll have some. We need to update on the travel in just a moment and the cricket in South Africa. But I just want to just tying those points then with where you were addressing Copenhagen just a few days ago, putting all those points together. If God created a universe that can evolve and develop, perhaps we don't need to worry about climate change.
The thing is that God's created a universe in which part of what's evolved is us. We've got brains, we've got skills, and if we trust what the Bible says, then those brains and skills are given us, among other things, to help look after the rest of creation. So if we step back from that responsibility, no doubt God in the long run will be able to cope, but the cost to us is going to be enormous. So our responsibility is real.
How would you describe relations with Rome at the moment and this year, Dr. Williams?
Well, we've had our ups and downs, but I think at the moment relations are pretty cordial. I was lucky enough to have a very good visit a few weeks ago, to meet the Pope and be able to talk very candidly about the situation. And we've now got the official talks between the two churches back on track. And I'm feeling quite hopeful about how those will go.
And what can you tell us about what you said to him and what he said to you?
Well, private conversations are private conversations, aren't they? But I think we both acknowledge that the way in which the announcement was made about the offer from the Roman Catholic Church for people in the Anglican Church to convert on certain conditions, the way that was handled was not very helpful to either of us, and that we needed to get beyond that, draw a line. It was a pastoral solution for certain people's problems, and we'll see how many people take that up. I don't think it affects the mainstream of our relationships.
The accusation, of course, was of discourtesy, and Bishop Tom Butler was making that very point that you should have been told this was going to be announced, and it was embarrassing to him and the Archbishop of Westminster, that no one appeared to know what was happening.
I think it's partly the way some of the departments in the Vatican work. There's a slight tendency to believe that there's nobody else out there.
So you don't see it as the Catholic Church trying to sort of muscle in on your traditionalists?
No, I don't, because I've got enough respect for the traditionalists in the Church of England and the Anglican Church generally to think that they'll make up their minds prayerfully and intelligently, and if that suits them, fine. But I'd be very sorry if it was a large number that went, because these are people who are an important part of our family.
Were you ever tempted, are you ever tempted, to say at any point to those in the Catholic Church who might be uneasy about where they are, you know what, okay, fine, I understand what the Pope is saying, but if you are after a more tolerant church, if you're looking for a church that on balance is more accommodating to women, is prepared to accept women as priests, at least has started to discuss the issue of homosexuality in the clergy, come and join us. Why don't you come and join the Anglican Communion? Are you ever tempted to get in touch with your inner Cranmer?
My inner Cranmer? Goodness, to the thought. No, it's an interesting question. I think what a lot of people don't realise is that there are quite a lot of, I say quite a lot, a significant number of Roman Catholics who do make that journey, who find a more welcoming home in the Church of England or other Anglican churches than they do in the Roman Catholic environment, and that goes on steadily and quietly year after year. I don't believe that getting up and making a great invitation, a great sort of sales pitch on that, is really going to help us. People know where we are.
You're never tempted just to be angry about this? Righteous anger, you know?
Occasionally, but, you know, what good does anger do? It may release your tensions for a bit. It doesn't actually make things more constructive, more creative.
Did this make you cross?
Briefly, yeah. I tried to deal with it.
Did you tell...
kicking too many cats.
Yes. Did you tell the Pope it made you cross?
I said it made things difficult. He knows that.
Did he do anything to make it worse?
I don't think he did, no. No, and I don't hold him responsible at all for what departments in the Vatican do. And our relationship, personally, has always been very good. We both have a bit of a track record as being professors of theology, so we've all got something to talk about.
It is obligatory to talk issues of sexuality. We've talked about this before. Maybe there will come a time where it's possible to interview the Archbishop of Canterbury without the vexed issue of sexuality. Yeah. And
I know, don't hold your breath.
But it ain't going to be happening under your tenure, Archbishop. Mm. One imagines a couple of issues. The lesbian bishop, beloved of headlines, Mary Glasspool, who has been much written about in the last few days. Depending on which side of the argument you are, there's either a symbol of hope or it's a portent of doom. How have you reacted to news of Mary Glasspool?
Well, I think I'd expected that her election was quite likely, and that the reaction to it would be, in a large part, the majority part of the Anglican world, very, very unhappy, very troubled. Partly because, of course, we have asked the Church in America very specifically, again and again, to slow the pace of change so that we can actually talk these things through together. The problem is that if one bit of our family goes ahead too fast with certain issues and assumes everyone's going to go in that same direction sooner or later, then it has the effect of shutting down real discussion, open discussion and debate in other parts of the church family. And I don't think that's good for us.
She has said, and there'll be people on her side of the argument, who wonder why a single attribute in her life defines her almost entirely. 3 decades, apparently, she's been in the ministry, she's been building congregations, talking about poverty, talking about racism. She says, and I quote, "You don't get a headline that says, well-qualified priest elected bishop suffragan of the Diocese of Los Angeles. You don't get fabulous preacher or great joyful person elected. What you get is lesbian priest." Do you accept that that's a source of profound irritation?
I can see why she says that. And none of this is about her capabilities as a human being, as a person, not at all. It is, though, about the fact that right throughout the Church's history and throughout most of the Church today, the way you decide to live your life, the relationships you're part of, are part of your ministry, part of what you bring to it. And if somebody is living in an active sexual partnership that the Church overall, doesn't bless or sanction, that just does pose a problem. And that's not in any way to diminish the enormous pastoral contribution that so many people make who are lesbian and gay. It's just that there's an issue because the Church has historically said this is not an acceptable form of life for someone in leadership. Now, that's the difficulty. That's what we're all wrestling with.
Yes. What would the Rowan Williams of 20 years ago made of that answer, do you think?
The Rowan Williams of 20 years ago would, I guess, have said, well, you know, archbishops talk waffle in generalities and seem to have more interest in keeping the show on the road than firm principle. And I think the Rowan Williams of 20 years ago would have been saying what he said because he didn't know what it was like to have these particular responsibilities of trying to keep the conversation going, trying to keep relationships alive in our Anglican family for the sake not just of peace and quiet, because that's not what we ever get, but the sake of the really constructive, transforming even relationships that can exist between churches in different parts of the world. And the fact is that the Anglican Communion, the worldwide family of churches related to the Church of England, is able to provide support and assistance for churches under pressure in Pakistan or Burundi or Sudan. It's able to exchange experience and wisdom between, you know, the United States, Kenya, and South India. And that flow of life, that flow of exchange, it's no small thing. And I want to keep that alive.
And so you have that side of the Anglican Communion with those headlines. And then, if you like, at the other end of the spectrum, but still on essentially the same issue, Uganda is in the process of introducing a new law which will punish homosexuality by imprisonment or death. As I understand it, and you may well have more information for me on this, the Anglican Church in Uganda hasn't pronounced on this issue, and you have been criticised for not actually coming up with an answer. I mean, you have spoken on this in the Daily Telegraph recently, but it took you a while to get there. What do you make of this and the accusations that you've been a little bit tardy here, Archbishop?
Okay, well, let's take it step by step. First of all, it's not in process of being introduced. It's a private member's bill. And like private member's bills in this country, it's tabled for discussion. It expresses where somebody, some individual or some little group wants the state to go. It's not government policy. And most private members' bills, by the time they get to final parliamentary debate, have been changed quite a lot. So it's a big mistake to think this is something that's just, you know, gone through. Now, I've read the bill very carefully, and it chills my blood, I have to say. It seems to encourage the setting up of informers' networks, almost. It makes pastoral care practically impossible. And naturally, I hope and pray it doesn't become law. What's happened has been that the church in Uganda has been engaged in quite a strong debate about this, and there have been voices within the Church of Uganda very, very critical of every aspect of this bill. The Church of Uganda as a whole has made clear that it cannot accept the death penalty, and that has, I gather, been removed from the draft bill now anyway. So there's quite a process going forward. I was reluctant to say anything in public about this for a while, though I'd been in contact privately with a lot of people, including the Archbishop in Uganda, and some of the opponents, some of the people who were just in the process. Reluctant to say anything too publicly, because it's very easy for people at a distance to make a noise about something with a counterproductive effect on the ground. I needed to know how comments from here would land. Would it make the bill more or less likely to get support? Many people said, the more someone like you talks about it, the more likely it is the bill will get support. And so my question is, do people want to make a noise or make a difference?
And you've decided to make a difference?
Try to.
And presumably then you have to think, if I'm not making a difference, then I have to start making a noise.
We'll have to see. But there's a lot of debate and discussion still to go on about this bill.
These are, given the caveats that you've just put in, they're kind of irreconcilable differences, aren't they, in the kind of basic approach to homosexuality being manifested, one in Africa, one in North America. The Anglican Communion cannot, with the greatest will in the world and with all your powers and all your staff, you can't keep that together, can you? Does there not come a point where you think it would be better and more honest to allow them all to do their own thing and go their own way?
I very seldom get to the point of thinking it would be better for anybody. When churches break up, it takes them hundreds of years to mend the wounds and get back together again. And I don't want to see us fragmenting, particularly over this issue. More honest? That worries me a bit more sometimes, because I'd really be very sad if the effect of all this were to make people unable to discuss the question. But the position is, I think, not so much that there are two, as it were, equally balanced voices in the Anglican family overall, but that the majority of Anglicans have put themselves fairly firmly on the side of traditional teaching here. A smaller group have said, well, we want to change it, and we are going to change it. Now, what I want is to see if the church as a whole can really tackle the question in such a way as to decide whether, as you know, as an international family, we want to move on this or not. And I don't minimise the difficulties of that or the likelihood of it all going pear-shaped. I just hope and pray that because this is the responsibility I've been given, I can keep on trying.
Does this issue, this story, sort of depress you more than any other? Or are there others? But I don't know. I mean, yeah. Is this a drag? Do you wake up and think, what on earth can I do to keep this communion together?
Oh, yes, yes. Quite often, I think. And it just seems to me so strange that in this century, with the problems that face us as a church, with the problems that face us as a human race, the big risk to the church should be dividing over an issue of sexuality. And I've no problem about the biblical ethic of sexuality as something that I, teach and believe important. And yet, for that to be the issue on which we all break up, I don't know. It seems to me very strange.
Question from Jenny via email. What do you think, Archbishop, about the banker's bonus scandal? Isn't it a sign of society gone totally wrong that when bankers are squabbling over such massive sums and others are homeless, wouldn't Jesus be in favour of higher taxes to close the gap between the rich and poor? He wasn't against the tax man, after all. But there's a clear story there just popping in at the end.
Absolutely. I think Jesus might very well have been in favour of higher taxes in the sense that he's somebody who constantly speaks for the poor, the people on the edges of things, and reserves his sharpest questions and challenges to those who feel they're at the centre and feel they're on top of the situation. But I think if we say it's all about taxes, we miss the other challenge of Jesus' words, which is, each one of us has the challenge to give. We can't just expect taxes and government to do it for us. We have to want people who are in need to be set free from their poverty. We have to want to share what we have because we know that it's for our life as well. Jesus says, blessed are those who are hungry and thirsty for righteousness. And I think that's a very powerful picture because it's as if he's saying, my feeling about justice, my desire to see justice happen, is like being hungry and thirsty. And until there's justice for somebody else, I'm hungry, I'm thirsty. There's something lacking. Now that's the kind of passion that really makes a difference. And that's where I found myself very moved in Copenhagen last weekend by some of the sheer passion of some of the people I met, some of the Christian activists who were there. And just two seats away from me in the cathedral on Sunday was Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who, of course, knows more about hungering and thirsting for justice than almost anybody else I know.
I wonder if people at the end of this year actually look less and less to politicians to make those statements that you're talking about, that if they're looking for moral leadership, they don't expect it from politicians of any colour.
Yeah, and that's rather sad, isn't it? Because there are people with principle and hope and passion in politics, and I think one of the casualties of this year really has been an extra level of cynicism about people in public life. I'd really like to see the time between now and the election in the coming year, a time when some of our politicians try and get that moral credibility back.
Yes, because you've spoken in the last few days of the government when they talk about religion and religious people. They seem to think about it in terms of an area which is practiced by freaks and foreigners.
Yes, and I didn't just mean this government, but almost anybody in the administrative world these days. The sense that being religious is just odd. And while archbishops who wear strange clothes in churches are probably not the best people to say this, you and I know that round the corner in every community there are people who are actually part of the working backbone of community life. The people, like the priests I mentioned earlier, in situations of real deprivation, but lots of lay people as well, who simply keep the life of communities going. They're not odd, they're not freaks. They're people who, as we say, have a heart for the life and the well-being of all the people around them. And that's an asset, it's not a problem.
You talk about increased cynicism. I wonder if some people might think, well, that's interesting. Yes, I realise that I'm more cynical. And they might say, OK, Archbishop, we're following the Chilcot inquiry. And we took seriously the words of our Prime Minister when he told us about weapons of mass destruction and the threat to this country that they posed. Mm. And he has now said in an interview that actually he would have supported the invasion of Iraq anyway, even if there weren't weapons of mass destruction. What did you think when you heard that?
I felt that's a very damaging thing to say. We'll have to wait till the inquiry does its business, of course, but I think the effect of hearing that was to make me and, I guess, hundreds of thousands of other people think, so were we arguing about the wrong thing back in 0203? Wasn't the real issue on the table? Because that doesn't really do anything for people's trust in public life.
Archbishop, we're out of time. I know you have to go, and I think you're robing up for the House of Lords. Is that right?
That's right.
Contributing to a debate there. I've interviewed you three times now, and I conclude each one by asking you whether you're enjoying your job. each time I've got the feeling that you kind of, well, maybe, but maybe not. Can I ask you then at the end of 2009 whether you're now enjoying being Archbishop of Canterbury?
Enjoying it in the sense that I enjoy spending time with my family or going to the theatre or listening to the music of Johann Sebastian Bach? Probably not. Committed to it and determined to be grateful for it and finding lots of joy and inspiration in it, visiting ordinary communities, schools, parishes around the country, yes.
Archbishop, thanks very much indeed for talking to us today.
Thank you.
The Archbishop of Canterbury, that's it. Thanks very much indeed for listening. Another tomorrow.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.